Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me, let's fly away.
So this is Ann Dalton with Sun Sounds, and this program is called Are We There Yet? We are going to an exotic location, the Atacama Desert and Pacific Coast in Chile. This story is written by Stanley Stewart from the Condé Nast Traveler. Road trips mean untold adventures, widescreen wilderness, and striking out alone. On a dramatic ride from Argentina to Chile, Stanley Stewart traces the continent's highest peaks, reaching the coast at a smartly unplugged camp. Wherever you are in the Atacama, you wonder about these mountains. The Andes are the gravitational pull of the continent, the long shadow, the backbone. They haunt the imagination. On the Amazon, you wonder what kind of mountains could possibly produce a river of this magnitude. On the wide steppes of Patagonia, you are always waiting for them to appear, for that first glimpse of snow peaks emerging from tangled clouds in the west. In a vertiginous village in the Peruvian Andes, I once met a woman who talked of their purity, of how the mountains were an escape from the corruption of the valleys and the lowlands and the towns. They've never been just geography. The Andes have defined borders, shaped history, stolen lives, broken hearts, inspired poetry, forged ancient civilizations, fed and watered a continent. When the clouds parted and the conquistadors first glimpsed them, they dreamed of gold and silver. When the Incas gazed up at those dizzy peaks, they saw gods and climbed the summits. I was in Buenos Aires, and I decided to go to the Atacama Desert and the Pacific Coast in Chile. I could have flown, of course, but I wanted to go the long way, by road across the Andes, through the spectacular mountain passes between Argentina and Chile. The Pacific was merely a destination. The Andes were the journey. In Argentina, some transitions leave you breathless. A 90-minute flight from the chaotic hum of downtown Buenos Aires brought me to the vast spaces of the Puna Catamarqueña in the country's northwest and the tiny terminal building at La Rioja, where I was picking up a rental car. I stepped outside into white highland light. The air bore the crisp, dry scent of sage. I shielded my eyes. In the distance, dark outlines on the horizons, the mountains were waiting. The altiplano of the Puna Catamarqueña feels like the world stretching its limbs after a long confinement. This is Argentina's outback, remote, arid, deserted, one of the loneliest places and most beautiful places in South America. Here and there, villages of mud houses huddled in the shelter of poplar trees, their leaves spinning in the wind. Railway tracks shadowed the road for a time, then veered away into fathomless distances. Away to the west, mountains rode the horizons, granite-faced, severe. Not the Andes yet, but the Cordillera of the pre-Andes. In the windswept village of Anillaco, I found Father Jorge standing in the empty nave of the 18th-century mud-brick church of Nuestra Señora de Rosario. It felt like an old barn. Only the elaborate altarpiece, made entirely of adobe, revealed its real purpose. Father Jorge was sticking paper cutouts of white doves along the bare walls. Alone here in his dusty robes, he seemed bewildered. "The children," he said, looking at the cutouts as if they were hieroglyphs he could not be expected to decipher. "They love to come here because it does not feel like a church." standing outside, we talked about the Paso de San Francisco, the Andean Pass I would cross into Chile the following day. It is almost as high as Mont Blanc, the highest summit in Europe, Priest said. His robes flapped about his legs as dust devils whirled across the plain. 100 years ago, they brought a piano across the Paso de San Francisco on the backs of mules. It was for the mission here. In that time, civilization came over the mountains from Chile. Pianos, books, icons, and wonderful jars of marmalade from England. That night, in the big bedroom at the end of the passage in Estancia Las Percas, I woke to the sound of shutters banging. When I got up and pulled aside the curtains, I could see the moonlit trees around the house tossing madly in the wind, their branches bent at impossible angles, their leaves stripping away in gusts of yellow. It was the zonda, the wind that comes down from the passes of the high Andes. They say it is crazy wind that unsettles people, that it shreds nerves, shakes beliefs, changes lives. In Canamarca, they can blame the zonda for anything. The following morning, I arranged to meet a guide in the small market town of Fiambalá. Nestor was going to accompany me as far as the Argentine border post at the height of the Paso de San Francisco. With his careful manner and elaborate gentility, he had an otherworldly air. In the car, he perched on the front seat beside me, his hands on the dashboard, gazing at the mountains ahead. I imagined him as a character from Tolkien and kept expecting to turn around and find him with a long-stemmed pipe and a cloak, the Bilbo Baggins of Canamarca. It helped that the landscapes were becoming fantastical. From the open valley of the Rio Chastrul, the road suddenly plunged into narrow defiles where the rock was blushed with several mineral colors, crimson, verdigris, malachite, violet. Pitched upward at convoluted angles, the strata of these rock faces bore the drama of Andean creation, of the clash of tectonic plates. The Andes are young, only about 60 million years old. Nestor was saying, his hands raised, his long fingers swirling. The continents were shifting, the oceans widening. He shook his head as if he had been caught up in this chaos himself. On a plateau of pale grasses, we passed a refuge hut standing on the roadside like a lonely bus shelter. In the thin air, I had begun to feel dreamy and disoriented. Condors circled, vicuñas with swan-like necks grazed on the shores of black mountain lakes. And once, I spotted a group of pale flamingos wading in the dark shallows, presumably longing to be pinker. As the road climbed, the great snow peaks of the high Andes floated into view one by one, rising from behind intermediate mountains like the main act coming through a chorus line. Los 6000, Nestor said. These 6000s, the highest points of the Andes, all over 6000 meters. There are more than a dozen of these giants ranged around the Paso de San Francisco. Nestor introduced them like old friends. There was Incahuasi, more than a mile higher than Mont Blanc, its flanks disfigured by ancient lava flows, its summit home to an Incan ceremonial platform. There was Ojos del Salado, Eyes of Salt, at 6,893 meters, the tallest active volcano in the world. Beyond was Cerro El Muerto, the Dead One, its southern slope armored with glaciers. At the height of the pass, where a tattered Argentine flag fluttered above the border post, Nestor shook hands with the officials. The zonda buffeted the car. He leaned in at the window to say goodbye. "Don't linger," he said. "We don't belong here." I watched him in the rearview mirror as I drove into Chile and thought about his odd comment. As part of the rescue teams based in Fiambalá, Nestor knew how alien these mountains were. On the way up, he had told stories about ill-prepared trekkers, about people who had been saved and people who had died. The thrill of these peaks is that they are not part of our world and can never be. Mountaineers may come and go, conquering summits. Travelers may cross these dizzy passes, hoping not to suffer altitude sickness while gaping at the stunning vistas. If there are angels here, we will not see them. Indeed, this is not a place where we belong. When we ascend to these passes, some balance tips. In the world we think of as ours, we are suddenly out of place, vulnerable and insignificant. Among these magnificent and alien summits, we are humbled, and humility about our planet is a lesson we are still learning. The no man's land between the Argentine and Chilean border posts stretches more than 100 kilometers across the heights of Paso de San Francisco, an eerie landscape of snow and black rock. An arena of stark new peaks loomed about me. Cerro Vicuñas, Barrancas Biancas, El Ermitaño, Copiapo, and El Solo at 6,190 meters, consisting entirely of dark sand. Then I fell into Chile on a road that was only a year old. For 4 hours I drove downwards, switchbacking through a complex mountainscape. Beyond the confinement of the gorges known as La Solta, the Jump, I emerged on the Salar de Maracunga, a long antiplano of salt flats, lagoons, and gravel plains scarred by floods and avalanches. Finally, at the bottom, I found the Atacama Desert. Night was falling. The city of Copiapo appeared like a mirage, shimmering and unreal. When it vanished behind me as miraculously as it had appeared, I wondered if I had imagined it. The road was empty again. The dark country on either side showed no lights. Following the GPS, I turned down a country track. The low scrub of the Atacama was reduced to the beam of my headlights. Startled, a heron flew up and was swallowed by the night. At the end of the track, I stopped and climbed out of the car. There was a sound of waves and the cry of seabirds. I followed a path illuminated by lanterns among the rocks and found myself suddenly at Rora Nomade, a new beach camp on the Pacific coast. I had that fractured, surreal sensation of arriving in an unknown place in the darkness. A small group of friendly people were waiting for supper while ocean spray rose from beyond the boulders nearby. I found myself shaking hands, exchanging introductions, accepting drinks. A table was being set, fish were grilling on an open fire. Someone was squeezing lemons, someone else was tossing a salad. People asked about the mountains and the journey. I looked up. Above us on this seashore, galaxies swarmed across the night sky, clearer and closer than any stars I had ever seen. In the League of World Deserts, the Atacama is a star tern. Running 1,000 kilometers through northern Chile, this is landscape pared back to skeletal form. Its barren splendors veer between bizarre mineral lakes, salt flats, bald mountains, hot springs and geysers, and indigenous villages lost in a time warp at the bottom of twisting ravines. NASA uses it as a testing ground for instruments for Mars missions. The clarity of the Atacaman atmosphere has prompted astronomical agencies to build their observatories here. The place is heaving with amateur and professional astronomers, and soon enough someone will have visitors peering through a telescope at galaxies so distant that the beam of light they are seeing left its stars 4,000 years before the Egyptians laid the foundation stone of the Great Pyramid. If the Andes made me feel insignificant, the universe was making me feel like the tiniest grain of sand. The spectacle of its landscapes has made the Atacama a popular place, drawing 300,000 visitors a year, almost all of them converging on the old trading town of San Pedro de Atacama in the north. But deserts need to be places of solitude and escape, and in the Atacama, this means heading to the splendid isolation of the south, where a handful of people are beginning to explore the stunning coast and mountain ramparts. It is here that Susanna Arungis built her camp. Originally, this stretch of coast was a family secret. They came every summer from Santiago to camp, to swim, to explore. They looked for treasure reputedly buried by British pirates, snorkeled for the best scallops in the Pacific, and kayaked to offshore islands. They found the jawbones of whales and the teeth of megalodons, the giant ancestors of sharks. They lay awake at night on the beach, watching for shooting stars among the dense constellations. Half a lifetime later, Susanna, now a renowned Chilean designer responsible for the elegant Ahuasi Atacama in San Pedro de Atacama, has returned to this remote place to create Huara Nomade, an homage to her childhood memories of distant summers. I spent 2 days here, living the life as a beachcomber on the edge of the Pacific, lolling on Bali beds among cushions and billowing fabrics, swimming beneath Pacific rollers, eating fabulous salads and grilled fish while pelicans perched on the rocks and bottlenose dolphins passed in the bay. At night, I gazed at stars as thick as grapes before retiring to a tent that would have suited a sultan with excellent taste in Andean fabrics. One morning, I set off with a guide for one of Atacama's most singular features, a great sand sea just to the north of Copiapó, covering some 300 square kilometers. They were the kind of pristine dunes that make filmmakers salivate and desert travelers go weak at the knees. Though dunes hardly does them justice, these are mountains of fine blonde sand with summits and valleys with spectacular ridges and canyons, all sculpted by winds into soft, sensual form. As the creeping light of the pre-dawn gradually began to extinguish the stars, we arrived on a saddle ridge where the guide unpacked a grand breakfast picnic. We drank coffee and munched warm pastries while a wilderness of dunes took form around us until the sun ran gently along the ridgeline like a caress. My itinerary was a round trip. After a few days on the Pacific coast, I was heading back to Argentina, back across the Andes, this time over the Paso de Agua Negra from La Serena. I found the Elqui Valley, full of orchards and vineyards and sweet colonial towns into the mountains along a route that the Inca had taken. In the lower gorges, I could see their old highway buttressed above a green river with courses of masonry. A second Andean pass within the space of a single week seemed like a surfeit of wonder. Paso de Agua Negra was just as impressive. I kept stopping and looking at Mountain Vistoso, vast and empty, so empty that they were somewhat heartrending. Somewhere up there in that thin air, I began to cry without really understanding why. I would have been more heartbroken coming down out of that pass had the Calingasta Valley not been so beautiful. In the morning, I woke in a lovely adobe hotel in the oasis town of Barrial, where breakfast was served in the garden. Bread and honey, fruit in bowls of café con leche, dappled sunlight leaked through the poplar trees, full of birdsong. Away to the west stood the great ramparts of the Andes. Prominent among them was the colossal snow peak of Aconcagua, the highest mountain in the Americas. Just over 30 years ago, an Inca mummy wrapped in Andean textiles was discovered near its summit. For those who left him there, he was an angel. I know so little about angels, but all morning in Berryell, I could not take my eyes off that mountain. Well, after all that talk about desertscapes, here's one that will refresh your senses about a kayak trip in Thailand on the Run Ti River. And here it is. Realization on the Run Ti River. In the wilds of northwest Thailand, a friendly offer suddenly seems much more sinister. And this is by John McMahon, travel writer. Traditionally, 40 is a milestone birthday that weighs heavy. It's usually a time for slowing down and taking stock of life, but that never occurred to me. Instead of a party at some chain restaurant where acquaintances would prod me with joke gifts of canes and adult diapers, I was kayak camping alone in northwestern Thailand. Thailand has been my home for 13 years, and I spend as much time as possible kayaking its waters. When at home in Kanchanaburi, I kayak the River Kwai, made famous by the novel based on the railway bridge that spans it. During the rainy season, though, I head north to the densely forested mountains of Sangkabluri, where the rivers are flooded yearly by the monsoon. The hill tribes populate the entire mountainous border between Thailand and Myanmar. Some have always been here, and some have come more recently as refugees fleeing economic and ethnic strife. Karen villages tend to be remote and usually on the banks of a river. Such is the case with Khon Mang Tha village near where I plan to put in my kayak. After hiking most of the night, I arrived at the village just after sunrise. When I got to the river's edge, I found two local guys lounging by the water enjoying an early drink of rice wine. Karen people have their own language, but these two had worked construction in Bangkok and so spoke Thai at about the same level as I. They asked what I was up to. They offered to take me further upstream. The river would be narrower and thus the rapids bigger and the paddling more challenging. When I asked how much money they wanted to guide me, they waved it off. "Nothing, we won't go far, just for fun," they said. By not far, I assumed a couple of miles, maybe 45 minutes at most. An hour and a half later, I could still hear the river through the thick jungle to the left, but there had been no trail since we'd left the village. We were plodding waist deep through a tea-colored bog that I wouldn't have dipped a toe in if it weren't for my guides who took off their shoes and stepped in without hesitation. Covered in a thin layer of putrid ooze, we soon came to a small cascade where we jumped in and bathed. There was no way around the waterfall we would have to climb. It was only about 12 feet high, but I was beginning to doubt that my guides, whom I had met drinking grain alcohol at sunrise, really knew where they were. By then, my kayak bag was digging into my shoulders. I slung it off and handed it up the waterfall to one of my guides before climbing up myself. Instead of returning the heavy bag, my guide hefted it onto his back, putting the shoulder strap around his forehead the way any natural mountaineer would carry a load. Another hour, and we were still pushing through dense jungle. Suddenly, the terrible realization that these young men had lured me into the wilds to rob me became crystal clear. They wouldn't take any money when offered, and when I asked how they were getting back to the village, they'd made vague references to a raft or a boat. Did they mean my boat? I began to strategize and plan a defense. Getting away from them here would be useless, as they would track me down in no time. These hills and mountains were their backyard. We continued our single-file march, with me continuing to scheme. The jungle opened unexpectedly into a pineapple orchard laid out in rough lines. My guides pointed to a bamboo hut on the far side of the field and said, "Our friend's house," before striding off ahead. As I scanned the area, looking to make a break for it, one guide emerged from the hut, holding the kind of big, curved knife every Karen carries for cutting rattan. The others followed, holding aloft a couple of pineapples. They waved me over to the riverbank, where they sat on a flat rock and started to cut up the fruit. "Pineapple is very good after a walk," one of them said. The other nodded, smiling as he stuffed a juicy chunk into his mouth. As suddenly as my fears had arisen, they vanished. These men wished me no harm. They were happy to be out of the village, walking with a stranger, eating pineapple on the bank of a river under a blue sky dotted with fat white clouds. The river water was cold and clear. From where I stood on the bank, I could see a never-ending series of white-topped waves crashing among great slabs of boulders. Karens gave me their shoes to strap to the deck of my kayak. The boats they had talked about turned out to be two plastic jugs they would float on as they rode the rain-driven current back to their village. I hung back in the water, watching as they rose up over the 6-foot waves. Cold water had erased any fatigue from the hike as I followed my guides to their village. They emerged from the torrent, freezing but grinning. "You are strong swimmers," I told them. "I am. He cannot swim," the taller of my guides said. I looked at them aghast. They nodded, still smiling, and with no more than a wave, walked up the path back to their village. Well, that's all the time we have today. I will end the show as I usually do by noting a quote. This one from Ingrid Bergman. "Getting old is like climbing a mountain. You get a little out of breath, but the view is much better." So this is Ann Dalton with Sun Sounds Tucson. Tune in with us next week for the next journey.
Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly away.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Information and Audio, then under Program Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds podcasts on your Echo Dot or other smartphone devices.